Jerry, are you there?
I'm here, Don.
Okay, great. Well, it's nice to be with you today, and I wonder if we should start off. We're going to have a civil discussion today on immigration and our backgrounds and how we come to these issues from similar places, but you know, how we where we agree and where we disagree on some issues related to the immigration debate. So, Jerry, did you want to start off and kind of introduce yourself and say a few words about your background and how you come to these issues, and then I will.
Sure, Don. I'll be happy to do that. I became familiar with immigration as an issue 25 years ago when I began working in Mexico as the Northern Mexico correspondent for the Arizona Republic. I was working in the neighboring state of Sonora in the capital city of Hermosillo, which is where I was based. And at the time, I think I started out with basically an attitude of, gosh, let's have a very open policy. If people want to come, let's let them in. Why should that be a problem? But over the years, I began to think that there were sufficient issues and problems that we needed to be serious about managing immigration carefully, and especially on getting a handle on the illegal immigration. At that time, Don, if I could just take a minute to talk about the dimensions of the issue. At that time, 1986, the scholars were pointing out that most of the undocumented migrants from Mexico were coming from five or six states, mostly in west central Mexico. The big four were Jalisco, Guanajuato, Zacatecas, and Michoacan, and they were coming mostly to four or five of our states, of course, the big three being California, Texas, and Florida. But in the aftermath of the IRCA legislation, that meaning Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, we saw a great increase of both documented and undocumented immigration. As a matter of fact, one prominent immigration scholar, Philip Martin of UC Davis, has said that that was the principal effect of the legislation, was to expand immigration, both legal and illegal, across the United States. Because, as you know, once people got the legal status, they were free to move around the country, and then the networks sent out the word that there were jobs available, and we saw a big increase in a gradual building of the numbers that we see today. And so I observed that working in Arizona, I saw the big influx from Mexico that followed the peso collapse of 1994, and I thought that these were serious problems of numbers. The numbers in Arizona have grown quite impressively. If I could just refer to a couple, the estimated undocumented population in the state in 1990 was 88,000, and by 2007, the peak was 560,000. This obviously caused major issues for the systems, the schools, the neighborhoods, the healthcare system, and were part of the climate that produced SB 1070, which I'm sure we'll talk about. That's enough for me at that point, so I'd really like to hear about you, Don.
Sure, thanks. My name is Don Kerwin, and I'm Vice President for Programs at the Migration Policy Institute, and I think we probably, you know, came into the field at about the same time then. I was in Peru for a year after college, working on kind of a Peace Corps type of year down there, and working with people in kind of a third world country that actually didn't, you know, none of those people ended up coming to the United States. Which has been instructive to me since then. I think that what it taught me is that, you know, people basically, if they can, want to stay at home, if they can make lives for themselves at home. And I, after that, I came back and I went to a law school and I started to get involved in the immigration issue there in a fairly significant way through clinical work and representing asylum seekers. And these were people, from El Salvador and Guatemala, who had come to the United States fleeing the civil wars in Central America at that time, and then went to work in a law firm for a few years and basically answered an ad in the paper and started to work for the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, which is the U.S. Bishop's legal agency for immigrants. And I became, it was a very small agency at that time, and I became the director after a year, and was tasked with kind of overseeing a political asylum project for Haitians who had fled, you know, Haiti after Aristide was deposed for the first time in late 91, 92, and had been screened into the United States from Guantanamo Naval Base and needed representation in their asylum cases. So I did that and became the director of clinic thereafter and was there for 16 years. And basically what we were doing was trying to create legal programs for immigrants around the country, primarily through Catholic agencies, Catholic Charities, and other agencies, but also, you know, non-Catholic agencies as well. And we were kind of a legal support entity for all of these programs. And of course, I saw the growth in immigration pretty much firsthand from that perspective. Most of these programs would represent people who were trying to reunify with family members or trying to get work authorization or political asylum in some cases. We were also working in the detention centers. And so that's how I came into the field, and it's kind of how I've learned about immigrants. And, you know, about 2.5 years ago, I came to the Migration Policy Institute, and I'm doing more public policy work now, more, you know, writing, thinking, developing ideas, trying to figure out solutions to basically where we are as a country, which, you know, really worries me. I'm quite concerned at this point about national cohesion. You know, how our communities are doing, how our country's doing, and how polarized it is. So I really welcome the opportunity to talk to you, Jerry, about, you know, some legitimate, you know, honest differences that we might have, and some areas of convergence also that I know that we have. So
Don, I should have pointed out at the beginning that you and I actually come from a background of Catholic education, and I think Catholic social teaching has affected both of us. I actually went to the to Arizona in 1972 to work as a volunteer teacher and coach at a Catholic school on the reservation, and my first newspaper job was later at the Navajo Times, a weekly paper owned by the Navajo Nation, and that led ultimately to me going to work in Mexico for the Arizona Republic. But I've long, well, I don't want to say long, at least 5 or 6 or 7 years, been aware of your work. I have great respect for it. I know that it's based on entirely admirable principles of justice and fair play and human dignity. And I think that you and I share that goal. We just have, I think, in some instances, different interpretations of what those noble ideas mean in the context of our ongoing immigration debate. And at some point, I'd like to hear you talk, and perhaps we could talk a little bit about our understanding of Catholic social teaching. Not that we want to make this a discussion of Catholic doctrine or theological social justice principles, but to some extent, I'd be interested in. I think that would be illuminating to hear your point of view in that regard.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I'm also kind of more in a, I straddle both, you know, Catholic social teaching and approaching the issues from that perspective. And, you know, Migration Policy Institute is a good government kind of think tank. So it doesn't, it's not, you know, associated with any particular religion, of course. But yeah, I mean, you know, the basic idea behind Catholic social teaching is that people have a right not to have to leave their countries of birth and their communities of birth. In other words, they have a right to lead, you know, lives of dignity and to support themselves and their families and their home communities. And that's really the ultimate goal, to make migration something that's done voluntarily rather than by necessity. But, you know, if they feel compelled and if they are required to leave to support their families, then of course they have to be treated with dignity on the way. And you know, to the extent that nations can accommodate them, consistent with an overall vision of the common good, they should be welcomed and they should be incorporated and they should be integrated into their new countries. And that's it in a nutshell. It's, of course, a lot more complicated than that, you know, and
right.
the principles can be applied kind of, you know, at a much more granular level than way than that. But, you know, that's kind of the framework anyway.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you your comments on something that was said by an important member of the Catholic Bishops Conference, a 2004 conference at my alma mater, Notre Dame, Bishop Wenske, who framed the issue in what I thought was not a helpful way. If I could just read his comment here, and then I'd like to contrast that with what I thought was a much more useful and constructive statement in an MPI report from 2006. This is Bishop Wenske in 2004. He said, "I think we can make a summary of Catholic social teaching in one phrase. No human being can ever be considered as a problem. When we consider a human being as a problem, we depersonalize him, we offend his human dignity. When we allow any class of human beings to be categorized as a problem, then we give ourselves permission to look for solutions. And as the history of the 20th century has proven, sometimes we look for final solutions." I heard that and I was stunned that an important bishop leading the church's work on immigration at that time, the U.S. church's work on immigration at that time, would go within an eye blink from issues of immigration domestically to the Holocaust. I thought that was not helpful. Something that I do think was very helpful was something that was said in the introduction. Excuse me. I'll try not to scratch my nose. I just did that. of the MPI policy task force report of 2006, a very good framing of the issues. It said, "Few policy areas affect a society as directly or as deeply as do immigration and immigration policy. Large-scale immigration magnifies those effects enormously. The United States has been taking in unprecedented numbers of immigrants, legal and illegal, for over a decade now." I thought that by contrast to what the bishop said, the MPI approached the issue in a way that I thought was a very effective initial acknowledgement of the fact that there are issues, and yes, there are problems involving illegal immigrants. We don't want to personalize it. We certainly do nothing. I think it's repugnant to deny the humanity or the dignity of someone who is here, whether in a documented or undocumented fashion. But I think it's not constructive to say that you should not talk about problems, because if you do, then you're following in the path of Adolf Hitler. Just not a good way to have a civil discussion of a very important issue, I think, Don.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Bishop Wenske's, he's the Archbishop of Miami now, is a great hero of mine, actually, and he's also a personal friend, and he was the chair of my board at clinic for, I think, 3 years, maybe 6 years. And I knew him first as the parish priest of the National Haitian Parish in Miami, so he's very, very well known in the Haitian community. Mm-hmm. And I have heard him say before that we can't treat immigrants as a problem. You know, they're a solution to a problem. And I remember visiting him, for example, in his Haitian parish, and he would have Haitian immigrants, legal and undocumented immigrants, you know, providing meals, for example, you know, in soup kitchens in Miami. You know, it's kind of a way to show that, you know, these new immigrants really want to contribute to the country and really want to belong. I haven't heard him say that, you know, compare, and you know, immigrant restrictionism, for example, to Nazism or National Socialism, and I do find those kinds of, you know, comparisons, I don't like them and I don't agree with them, but I would say that generally, you know, Bishop Wenske's been a great hero and a champion of immigrants and on these issues. I agree with you, and I think, you know, the debate, it has to be civil. It really does. I mean, we're all in this together. I'm quite concerned about national cohesion at this time. I'm quite concerned at the fact that, you know, things are quite polarized, that there's obviously a need for immigration reform, and yet, you know, the prospects for it are not great over the next 2 years anyway.
Yeah.
And, And, you know, and to the extent that we can talk issues rather than, you know, invective, and to the extent that we can attribute good motives to each other, I think that's very, very helpful and very important. That's kind of what we need at this point in the debate, yeah. You know, facts, issues, honesty, yeah. Direct conversation rather than, you know, this these other kinds of attacks.
Yeah. I, you know, Don, I'm all with you on that. I agreed to do this, something quite new to me, because I respect you and had confidence that you and I would have a civil discussion and we would get away from so much of the venom and vehemence that has characterized the debate. Certainly, I have experienced with great frequency the accusation that because we raise the concerns that we do at the Center for Immigration Studies that our motivation is bigotry, xenophobia, mm-hmm. and we are anti-immigrant. I reject that, and I think that if a solution is to be found, it's going to be in dialogue with people who bring to the issue the understanding, the deep personal involvement, and the commitment to solution finding that you bring, Don.
Well, thank you. So why don't we get in? Why don't we talk? You know, why don't we talk about some of the issues then? Let's jump in and kind of. I mean, I don't know if I'd be happy to kind of talk about where I'm coming out on some of these issues right now. What I see are some of the prospects, you know, or some of the barriers and challenges to reform of the system. I don't know if that's a good way to kick it off, or if you want to suggest some other way to do it.
No, that would be fine. I look forward to that.
Okay. So, I mean, I think the basic issue and vision here is that the immigration policy ought to serve the national interest, and you know, by that it's not just economics and labor needs and those kinds of needs, but also, you know, the core values of the country, you know, family reunification and other important values. Yeah. And you know, we've been talking about comprehensive immigration reform for a long time here. And I think, you know, we're still talking about it, but it's important to describe what we mean by that. In other words, there's three kinds of areas. You know, one is reform of the legal immigration system. One is, you know, how to treat the people who don't have immigration status, the unauthorized at this point. And then the third piece is enforcement. And I think that all of those pieces, all of those elements are still on the table. Although we're not likely to see kind of a broad-based earned legalization program over the next 2 years. So, I might just talk, do you want to talk about them in order? Maybe we could do that.
Sure.
And then we could talk about what's happening in Arizona and other
sure.
places. Okay,
sure.
So, I think for the unauthorized, you know, the way that I look at that is basically, you know, from the mid-90s at least up to around 2006, you had lots of people coming into the country, and most of them at a time where there was very low unemployment. Most of them were you know, risking their lives to come, of course, but they were finding jobs here. And, you know, there were certainly problems with that. There were problems related to the rule of law. There were problems related to the risks that these folks ran. Their labor market issues and the like, but nonetheless, those problems became, you know, fairly severe kind of when the Great Recession hit, and of course the unauthorized numbers have gone down since then. I think, you know, where we are in the debate is ultimately the, you know, there's 11 million people here. We're going to have to do something about them. I mean, I disagree with the kind of SB 1070 plus kind of approach, the deportation by attrition approach, you know, mm-hmm. the idea that you can remove or make life so difficult for people that ultimately they're going to leave. And partially it's because, you know, I know that that would push 7 million people who have jobs out of the workforce and what it would do to immigrant families. But I'm also concerned about the kind of country we are, you know, some of the proposals related to denial of birthright citizenship and, you know, effectively denying kids the right to a primary and secondary education, which is a big push in some of these laws now. And I just think we're kind of a better a better country than that. And I think, you know, what's happened is we have this undifferentiated sense, or the public does, of who the unauthorized are, and yet there's some very sympathetic, a lot of sympathetic groups within that, and somehow that's, you know, that's been lost. The people who have been here for a very long time, for example, the people who have been approved for family-based visas, there's large numbers of those, you know, who have basically tried to adhere to the law, but are stuck in long backlogs. And I think, you know, the young people that were raised here, the dreamers, you know, who I think are kind of remarkable in the sense that, you know, Europe has these major problems related to alienated citizen immigrant youth. And we have these unauthorized youth who want to belong, who want to contribute, who are trying to go to school and trying to work and all of that. So I think that, you know, perhaps there's some opportunity there to focus on some of the smaller groups over the next couple of years. And that's kind of how I'm looking at the unauthorized at this point. I think ultimately we're going to have to do something about the 11 million. The deportation by attrition is really not the solution.
Yeah, I could pick up on that by saying that I believe we should pass the DREAM Act. I think the kids who are doing well in school, who want to go to university, I think they should be provided every opportunity to do that. These are our kids now. They're not going home. Their success will be our success as a nation, as a society. Their failure would be our failure. I am far more concerned about the dropout rate among Latino kids, the teenage pregnancy rate. You know, both are the highest levels in our country. We need to find a way to embrace those kids and to do what we can so that they will be successful, because they are in ever increasing numbers. I think that the dimensions of the issue are a bit broader than you were indicating, Dan, because what I get to do at CIS is a lot of reading and research, and I try to become a student of the history of immigration, and it's very clear that the concern and alarm about rising numbers of illegal immigration began building in the late 60s, and we had the first effort to pass legislation to stop it in the early 70s, and Father Hesburgh's Select Commission on Immigration and Refugee Policy that issued its report 30 years ago expressed great concern about illegal immigration and said we need to be serious about stopping it. Barbara Jordan's commission several in the 90s, Barbara Jordan, a civil rights icon, who said that she was quite alarmed about illegal immigration as well, and also thought that we should reduce legal immigration. We now give out about a million green cards a year as a country, which is more than double the rate of the 1970s. And one of my concerns about the comprehensive immigration reform bill as presented most recently in 2007, at least presented to receive significant attention, is that it's not that it would legalize those who are here now illegally. I think we will need to do that, just pragmatically we'll need to do that, but that it would greatly increase legal immigration, because as you know, a green card is not just a right to permanent residence, doesn't just convey that. It also is an entitlement, because people who are here in permanent status, whether as green card holders, permanent residents, or as citizens, get to bring in their relatives. And that's another concern that I have, is the rapid population growth that is being driven primarily about immigration, immigrants or their children. And one of my concerns is that we no longer have a population discussion in our country. I'm old enough to remember when there were great concerns about rapid population growth. You know, we had 200 million in 1967. Now we're on a course to double that by around 2040, and I think we could easily hit 600 million by the end of the century if we maintain the immigration rate that we've seen in the past 30 years. I'm concerned that it's no longer, I think, politically correct to talk about population growth in our country. It used to be considered a very progressive concern. The founder of Earth Day that we just marked, Senator Gaylord Nelson, a liberal lion, was himself very concerned. He said we needed to be to reduce immigration in order to get control of our population growth. But that's a discussion that we're simply, and I think regrettably, not having, Don.
Right. Well, so I think you've, I'm glad that you're in favor of the DREAM Act, and I think that that's hopefully a no-brainer. I mean, I hope that there's broad support for that, and pragmatically, for pragmatic reasons, are recognizing that it's not that we do need to do something. We do need to legalize in some way, you know, the unauthorized who are here, kind of an earned legalization, whatever form that takes. I mean, I agree with you. We're quite concerned here, and we're quite focused on immigrant integration issues. There's, you know, 38 million foreign-born people in the United States, and, you know, you add their children, you're talking about 75 million people.
Yeah.
That's an extraordinary number, and it's quite safe to say that, you know, the success of those people is going to be crucial to the success of the country in the upcoming years. And so, you know, like one of the proposals that we have here is to create, you know, a White House office on immigrant integration that really brings together all of the federal and state players and businesses and others, private players on these integration issues to, you know, to make sure we're doing everything we can to integrate this population and also to look, you know, if that's not happening, that should inform our immigration policies, our legal immigration policies, right? So that should be part of the equation. The other, to me, the issue is not numbers so much in terms of the legal immigration system. I think, you know, the question is, does it work? Does it do what we want it to do? And we have a proposal from the very report that you were quoting from earlier of creating a standing commission on labor and immigration that would basically study labor market needs, would study unemployment, changing demographics in the country, and would identify where there's a need for workers by location and by skill level. And I think that we've had mismatches both on the lower end and, you know, on the higher end as well in terms of, you know, our competitiveness as a country. And so, and in times like now, of course, the need would be, you know, far less than it's been in the past. But there's this issue of kind of like a very significant mismatch where you've had, you know, 5,000 permanent visas available to low-skilled workers at a time when, you know, 500,000 people were coming in, and 90% of the men anyway were finding jobs. So how can we kind of align these things correctly so that the system, which really hasn't been the legal immigration system, which really hasn't been reformed since 1990 and hasn't been overhauled since 1965, you know, think about everything that's changed in the interim, can be reformed and can be successfully reformed. And again, you know, it's not so, even in Catholic teaching, I think it's not so much about numbers. It's about, you know, the dignity of the people and the like. And I think here it's, from a good governance perspective, it's a national interest issue.
Yeah. Now, I think very good points. I disagree with you somewhat on the openness toward unskilled immigration. I think that's one of our problems is that the vast majority of the undocumented immigrants are unskilled and poorly educated. That's one of the things that hit home to me as a reporter along the border as I would talk to people who had been picked up by the Border Patrol or down in Mexico, people who had been returned to Mexico. I would try to get a sense of their background, and frequently they were very poorly educated. The average was about 6.7 years, according to studies of school, in Mexico, and I am very concerned that these folks are likely to get stuck at the bottom rungs of an economy that's losing many of its middle rungs. I'm very concerned that we may be seeing the establishment of a new, rapidly growing underclass at a time of decreasing economic mobility in our country. You and I are both concerned about cohesion. This, I think, is an important part of that debate. If I could just, as you know, I was a reporter for many years, and so I look for illuminating quotations. And here's one from a recent book by a couple of economists, one Pia Orenius, who is at the Federal Reserve Bank, I believe, in Dallas, and her economist professor, colleague, Madeline Zabodny. If I could just read a comment that they make about where we are with our immigration. Immigration boosts the U.S. economy, spurs innovation, enhances productivity, benefits consumers by keeping prices low, and enriches our society and culture. But current immigration flows are disproportionately low-skilled and unauthorized, which leads to adverse effects on the earnings of competing native workers. It also creates an adverse fiscal impact, with low-wage immigrants receiving more in public services than they pay in taxes on average. I think that's very well said, Don, and from living in Arizona, I know that the fact of the dependence upon social services is part of the anxiety that we're seeing in Arizona manifesting itself in SB 1070. And I think what we need is a pact, a civic pact, where we would have our leaders, our president, President Obama, and hopefully important leaders on the Republican side, coming together to say, we believe that for our good as a society, we need to embrace the immigrants who are among us. But at the same time, as we ask for our fellow Americans to help to integrate, to accept, and to involve new immigrants in our life as a nation, we at the same time say we're going to get serious about stopping future undocumented immigration. We're going to be very serious about stopping, to the extent possible, illegal immigration, because part of the problem in Arizona, Don, and increasingly in other parts of the country, is that people are feeling overwhelmed. I know that very well in Arizona, and I think that that's a big part of the spirit of SB 1070. I think SB 1070 is a mistake because for the first time it's dividing people on ethnic lines. I know for a fact from living in Arizona that many Mexican-American families who have been there for many generations are very concerned about the negative effects of illegal immigration. They voted for Proposition 200 in 2004, which was designed to deny access to services to undocumented immigrants. And why, according to polls, did 47% of Latinos in Arizona vote for that Proposition 200, which was labeled racist, xenophobic, anti-Mexican, anti-immigrant, the usual epithets? Well, because they are affected as citizens of our country by this large-scale immigration that we have seen intensify in recent years. Although, admittedly, since the recession began, it has scaled back in Arizona. It's now down from a peak of well over 500,000 to about 470,000, I think, the undocumented population, according to most recent estimates.
Right. Well, I think you're raising a lot of issues there. I think I wasn't arguing that the unauthorized were mostly highly skilled. I mean, I know that they're lower skilled, and I think the argument there was more that's why they didn't have the ability. And they're finding lower skilled jobs, of course, service sector jobs and the like in the United States. The fact was, though, that they didn't have the ability to come in legally. It's more of an argument for we need to do something about the people that are here at this point. Mm-hmm. Rather than an argument about whether they're skilled or unskilled. I think the underclass issues. Obviously, we all ought to be quite concerned about those types of issues. And I think, obviously from a religious perspective, where we come from faith traditions that care about, the poor, and the Catholic tradition has this concept of the preferential option for the poor, which means that you have to take, the plight of the poor into account when you're making public policy decisions and personal decisions. We should sure. be very, very concerned. And, partially this is why I'm so concerned about proposals, for example, that would deny, citizenship to children that are born here, or that would deny yes. schooling to kids that, yeah. Are unauthorized or the like. I think that creates a permanent underclass, and that's something that we've never had in this country, and something we really, really need to avoid, and we need to be quite intentional about avoiding and fighting. And then I think, on the public benefits, there are major public benefit implications, particularly related to healthcare and education, which are born mostly on a local level. You know, the federal government, as I read the literature, tends to benefit, you know, in terms of taxes. Mm-hmm. The contributions mm-hmm. of unauthorized states and localities tend not to, or they don't. And you know, there's this kind of mismatch that occurs, and that needs to be reconciled and fixed as well. So,
yeah. Well, I agree, and I'm looking for a quote from Paul Krugman on the very point that you're making. I'm not sure that I have it.
Well,
up.
I should say that Pia Arrhenius, you know, writes for us and is part of our labor market advisory group.
Yeah.
So we're looking at these. We value her work quite a bit, and we know her work, yeah. And we even commission some of her work. So I think, you know, on the enforcement issue. Yeah, go ahead. I was going to talk a little bit about enforcement, but go ahead.
Okay, I guess before we get to enforcement, if I may, I think Pia is working in what, you know, I'm calling, many people call the, you know, the mythical, sensible center, where we can find common ground and get into problem-solving mode. But you talked about our concern for the poor. I think that one of the dilemmas here, Don, is that the effect of large-scale immigration of low-skilled workers is that it has tremendous effects upon our own native-born poor who are trying to get a foothold on the ladder, you know, who have arguably a greater claim to the American dream than people who come here crossing our border illegally. This is a concern that Paul Krugman raised, I thought, very eloquently. Robert Samuelson of the Washington Post has also written about these effects, but he laments the fact that that most American journalism has not acknowledged these negative effects. He says that reporters tend to identify with the downtrodden, and they think that those who raise these concerns about immigrants must be mean-spirited, and so they don't get attention.
You don't have to be. I mean, I don't think you have to be. No, of course you don't. One doesn't follow from the other. You're not mean-spirited if you raise these kids. I mean, I think the literature shows that, you know, that there's something like around the five. You know, if you wanted to, there's a different range, but around the 5% decrease in the wages of people who don't graduate from high school, natives who don't graduate from high school as a result of, you know, the heavy unauthorized migration mm-hmm. population. That's a big concern. I don't know. I mean, some of this is tied to globalization, though, too. I started off, I used to go to El Paso frequently, and at that time, Levi Strauss had a big factory in El Paso, right? And those were all good middle-class jobs for people that generally weren't, you know, college-educated, and weren't English speakers, you know, but were here legally. And pretty soon after, you know, I'd been going for a couple of years, those jobs moved to Mexico, right? Mm-hmm. All of those people lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. And since then, the Levi Strauss, as I understand, has moved from Mexico to China or to Asia somewhere.
Yeah. And, you Race know, to so, the bottom. Yeah.
So, I mean, part of this is a globalization issue as well. And that just seems like, you know, a lot of people have concerns about how that works or doesn't work, what it does to wages, what it does to the middle class. But it's a heavy thing to put it all on, you know, the immigrants themselves. You know, they're in some ways they're survivors or responding to globalization as well. And that's part of the challenge too, is that, you know, they can't move legally, but, you know, goods, services, et cetera, can move legally. And you know, the fact that NAFTA and some of these agreements didn't come with kind of immigration provisions has been a real problem. And I'm sure you know as a reporter that a lot of those, you know, small family farmers in southern Mexico were displaced after NAFTA, and some of them even joined the U.S. migrant labor stream. So you have some people that are really caught in the middle here.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the issue of the campo, the Mexican countryside, you know, where 25% of the population has been producing 5% of the GDP, that has been a problem for many years, and I think NAFTA in certain parts of the country definitely accelerated it. Although I remember when I was working in Mexico was lamenting that it had a balance of trade deficit with the U.S. Now it's well over $50 million is their surplus, I believe. So, mm-hmm. But I think the idea that because goods should move across the border easily. Therefore, people should. I don't accept that. I don't think it follows. A television set does not need education, does not need social services. Television set is not a human being with all the complicating human requirements. The famous saying about guest workers in Germany, we wanted workers, but they sent us human beings. I think, right. The famous externalities that are caused by these types of movements can be very, very strenuous for a society. And
it's just to me, I think the basic point to me, Jerry, is that people, as a result of globalization, big trade agreements, people lose their jobs. And, part of the logic of globalization is that people not only, the people have to actually move to where there is work. And in some cases, that's not in their country, so.
Yeah. Don, just if I could, almost parenthetically, one concern I have relates to the work of Andrew Sum at Northeastern University, who is concerned about the displacement of young Americans from the workplace, very high rates of unemployment among young Americans. And I've noticed, when I was growing up, 100 years ago, I worked construction. I cut grass. I scrubbed floors. I worked at a McDonald's. And now I look around my area, Montgomery County, Maryland, and all that work seems to be done by immigrants and, good people. I talk with them. I get to know them. I try to understand their world. And nothing against them at all. Good, decent human beings. But I wonder what the effect of it is for young Americans who are not developing the habits of working hard, showing up, taking orders from a boss, working with other people. Andrew Sum raises these questions in a very eloquent fashion. I'm not saying this is a big part of the debate, but I do think it's part of the debate that should be considered. The fact that employers want workers. If you've got 100 hours to schedule, you're a shift manager at McDonald's, you can either try to balance the schedules of 10 high school kids who are worried about their fight with their girlfriend and going to the football game on Friday night, or you can find two folks here from Mexico who are willing to work 50 hours each and will work more than that if you've got the hours available. It's very understandable why employers want to hire these folks, but some of the other effects are problematic.
Yeah, I think, I grew up in this area, too. I don't remember, for example, there being a major lawn care kind of industry, Mm-hmm. There weren't, and so I think, the immigrants actually brought that, back when there was, one in 22 in this area were foreign-born. Now it's one in six, In some ways, they're creating jobs. And, I have family up in Connecticut, and, young people at that time used to, sometimes go pick tobacco in the summers. I guarantee mm-hmm. that young people wouldn't do that now. And I'm not sure that the immigrants are to blame for that,
No, I agree. I think there are some sectors like tobacco, dairy farming, where I think it makes perfect sense to find immigrant workers. I just want the employers to do their part, to recognize these aren't just workers, they're human beings, to pay them decently, to help them integrate, to facilitate communication, especially to help their children. The first generation is always going to work hard, Don. The second and third generations, not so sure. We have some issues with those kids who are a big part of our future.
Yeah. Can I say a couple things about enforcement, too, just to kind of...
Sure.
Because, we're talking about the workplace now and the role of employers. And, sure. I think, and we're on record as doing this, we've written reports on this at this point, that there are some very, very significant enforcement pillars in place right now. The Border Patrol, we still need to kind of define what control of the border is and what a secure border would look like. But, the apprehensions are down fairly significantly at this point, down to the mm-hmm. 1960s levels. We have some significant post-arrest and post-conviction screening programs that are putting a lot of people mm-hmm. into removal proceedings. We have, more I-9 audits in the workplace. Mm-hmm. We have criminal prosecutions of people coming, across. We have state and local measures. In other words, there's a major detention system. And, and people have concerns with aspects of those systems, those pillars of enforcement. But the fact is, you know, certainly, you know, I would say most people basically support enforcement, you know, and significant enforcement. And I think that it does have to be a pillar of, you know, of reform. There has to be meaningful enforcement. And the best way to do that, of course, I think, is through the workplace. I mean, people come to work. And
I'm sorry. If I may respectfully agree with the thrust of what you're saying, but also disagree to the extent that I think many immigration advocates do not believe there should be enforcement and are not serious about cooperating in it. I think we saw that after IRCA was passed. Roberto Soro, in his very interesting book, Strangers Among Us, wrote about the National Council of La Raza doing everything it could to thwart effective worksite enforcement. I think that there are many people on that side sincerely believe that immigration enforcement is wrong and should be stopped and certainly should not be cooperated with. And I hope that your voice prevails in this, because I don't think we're going to have a solution unless that is acknowledged and accepted. If we're going to have another legalization, if we're going to have another IRCA four times as big in terms of the number of people who are legalized, you cannot have another failure of worksite enforcement measures, it seems to me.
Well, it seems to be the thing that's happening anyway. I mean, to the extent that we've had reforms or policy action, it's been on the enforcement side. And just looking at the numbers, you know, INS's budget, which included, you know, benefits in 2002, which was about its last year of existence, was $6 billion. And right now you have, you know, the two immigration enforcement agencies, not even counting the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, their budget's $16 billion. So, I mean, there has been like a pretty significant commitment, and I'd say it's a bipartisan commitment. I think, you know, the advocacy groups that I know, they've been pushing comprehensive immigration reform as opposed to kind of what they call an enforcement first or a removal only type of system, by which they mean, you know, tie legalization to, you know, increased enforcement. But I don't see, it may be that they don't champion particular enforcement programs, and they find fault in particular programs, which we do as well. But I don't see kind of open border people in any significant number, and certainly not among mainstream groups at this point.
I guess my optic is somewhat different, but Don, I certainly hope you're right. So I'll defer to you on that point for now, anyway.
Do you So we've kind of talked about legal immigration, we've talked about people without status, we've talked about enforcement a bit. Are there any other kind of areas here? I think we were supposed to go on for about 45 minutes or 50 minutes, and I know you wanted to end with kind of a special treat for whoever might be listening to this.
Well,
any final things? I can't think of anything right offhand. We could talk about SB 1070, but I think we've kind of talked about that to a certain extent, and the deportation by attrition vision. And
I would like to, you know, go to one, I think, really apt quote. It actually comes from 1983, I think. It's an editorial in the New York Times. Now, I'm certainly no fan of the editorial and op-ed statements by the New York Times over the past decade. But I think 25, 30 years ago...
How can you not like the Times, Jerry? You're a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. You must like the Times.
I have tremendous respect for the New York Times. I do. I have some real issues with their coverage and commentary on immigration. That's another story, Don. I've blogged about that. I'll put some things up for this.
I know you have.
But let me just...
I'm teasing you. You can't... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you're good at it. You're very good at it, and I appreciate that. But this is from a New York Times editorial. I think it was 1983. Again, I'll have the site. The Times says this: for reasons of vitality, humanity, and history, America wants and needs immigrants. What it does not need is such an uncontrollable flood of illegal migrants that it tries public patience and foments a backlash against all newcomers. That's the genuine danger. I think that's what we're seeing now, Don. And I think that we need to have a scaled back immigration in order for it to have the economic and the civic space for it to be successful. That's certainly what Barbara Jordan believed. And she's one of my guide stars on this issue. I think that's very right. I think that you can't have too much of a good thing, and that immigration to be successful needs to be limited.
Yeah, I think, you know, like just kind of in response, I think that we do need a comprehensive solution to the problem, you know, that addresses those three prongs that, you know, maybe not exactly in the way that some of the legislation over the last 6 years would do so, but, you know, ultimately we have 11 million, we have to fix the legal immigration system, and we have to enforce the law in a significant and meaningful way. And I think you're totally right. I mean, the big challenge right now for all of us is the immigrant integration challenge. That's really the immense challenge that's facing the nation. 75 million people, 25% of the country. Those people have to be successful here, or the country's not going to be successful.
I agree.
My quote, I love the George Bush quote from his first inaugural address, where he said, you know, this has always been a country based on ideals, and it's the country where no insignificant person was ever born. So I hope that we remember that too, kind of, you know, and we don't go the way of denying schooling, denying citizenship to kids born here, and the like. I think that's very, very important to kind of, as we fix these problems and address these challenges, you know, not go down that route.
I agree. I mean, the folks over here are part of our future. They're part of our country. We need to embrace them and try to ensure their success in civic and in financial integration into our country. I apologize. I've been looking off the screen, Don. That's because I was trying to set up the YouTube video that I think you were getting ready to introduce.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is from this is a song from Mexico, Los Hermanos Ortiz, who many years ago wrote a song playing upon the idea that Superman had come to the U.S. illegally, and that basically he was like them. And why is there a double standard? Why is Superman allowed to stay while we are not? And I think there's kind of a news hook here, because I just heard on NPR this morning that the new Superman comic has him renouncing his citizenship because of the fury over immigration, and he's now declaring himself a citizen of the universe, I think, or of the world. So much for truth, justice, and the American way. But look, Los Hermanos Ortiz, in a very whimsical, ironic, also pointed way, played with the idea with their song Superman is Ilegal. If you want to look it up in YouTube, it's Ilegal, I-L-E-G-A-L. Very clever song. It starts out without not saying it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. One guy starts out saying it's a bird. Another guy says it's a plane. A third guy says no, es un mojado, meaning he's undocumented. Right. And the song goes from there. It's very good, very clever, and thanks to the NPR report today about the comic, I think quite topical. So I'm going to try to start this thing up, and maybe we can go out with a little bit of music.
So it's another group of unauthorized immigrants, the superheroes who are worthy of legalization, right?
Well, and you know, there is a great literature that develops that theme. Mm-hmm. You know, and they don't hear voices like mine because Spanish language news doesn't recognize the legitimacy of any of these arguments. That's another point. But I really like this song from Los Hermanos Ortiz. So without further ado, I'm going to try it now. Don, maybe we can go out with this, as they say. Can you hear it, Don?
Yes.
He says, just like me, he's undocumented. So, Anyway, that's up on YouTube. Los Hermanos Ortiz, Superman es Ilegal. Thanks, Don. I enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you, Jerry. So we'll check out now.